Bankless Nation, it is the third week of December. It's time for the Bankless Weekly Roll-Up. I've got Anthony Sassano here. David Hoffman is off, not climbing mountains this time, Anthony, but he's like apparently circling around them somewhere in Argentina right now. So this is like a hike expedition, not a mountain climb expedition. How you doing, man? Actually, it's super late where you are, so I want to thank you for doing this recording. You're all the way in Australia. It's like, I don't know, it's like 12 a.m. or something like that. And I know you always wake up bullish, Anthony, but my question to you is, do you also go to bed bullish?
Yes. Well, thank you for having me on again. And yes, I wake up bullish. I go to bed bullish. And I sent to you in a message before. I said, it's okay if we have to record this late because I'm always bullish on ETH. So it doesn't matter.
Thanks, fan. Well, we appreciate that. I'm amazed actually that you go to bed bullish because like I tend to wake up bullish. And then just the day, you know, if you spend enough time on crypto Twitter, it like beats you down until you're like not as bullish as when you woke up, and you have to like go sleep and dream about like, you know, high crypto prices in order to refresh yourself for the next day. But I'm impressed that you stay optimistic and you're able to go to bed bullish too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can wear everyone down over time, depending on how much time you spend. You know, people get burnt out, things like that. But I don't know, like it's for me, I spend the whole day talking to a bunch of different people within the ecosystem, just researching a lot about Ethereum, checking out all the new updates, and it just keeps me going, keeps me bullish. Yeah, it's just very hard to be bearish. Like even if the prices are going down, just so much stuff happening in Ethereum, which obviously we're going to talk about a bit today, but yeah, just very, very easy to be bullish, I think.
Well, speaking of prices going down, that is pretty relevant to the topic today. So prices are down, Anthony Sassano. We're going to talk about that. Also want to get some takes from you and others on where we are in the cycle. So there was the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, there was a meeting this week. They did something with interest rates. We'll talk about that. Also, some big layer two news on Ethereum. So Kraken's Inc., this is their layer two. It hit mainnet. This was unexpected. This was ahead of schedule. We'll talk about that. Also, there's a $1.5 trillion bank launching a layer two. What does that mean? And ENS, you know, the .eth domain names, they picked their layer two. So we'll discuss that too. Pudgy Penguins also did an airdrop. Talk about that. There's some DeFi drama. I want to get your takes on this. We've got crypto developer numbers, a whole report. And guys, stay tuned to the end because what we're going to do is I'm going to get Anthony's .eth address. I'm going to plug it into the Bankless on-chain version of Spotify Wrapped. And we're going to actually see his score to see how bankless he is, what he's been up to on-chain this year. So all of that and more. Thank you guys so much for tuning into the Bankless Weekly Roll-Up. All right, Anthony, let's get to prices. And, you know, not as good as they have been previously, but actually, at least at the time of recording, we're still up on the week. The last time we recorded, we're up on Bitcoin about 1.5%. So Bitcoin is hanging out at 101,000. So we're still above 100K. We've got an ETH price down more significantly, down about 5 to 6% at the time of recording, from 3,900 last week to 3,682. And the big question is, are we down because the Fed cut interest rates? I thought cutting interest rates was a good thing, but apparently some of the news, the Fed had their meeting this week, bringing the target interest rate from 4.25%, from 4.5% to 4.25%. But they indicated that there would only be two reductions in 2025. And the market was hoping for four reductions, not two. What's your take on the prices this week? And like in general, like, why are we down? I thought this was a bull market. I thought we were just like infinity up only.
Yeah, I mean, it can feel like that. I think once you get towards the ends of a bull market, you will start to get like that up only every day or every week for kind of a few weeks or a couple of months or something like that. But I think people obviously always need to zoom out and kind of contextualize things. 1 week worth of price action is not really going to tell you much. And people will always look for different reasons as to why movements happen. Obviously today, people will be pointing to the Fed stuff. Tomorrow, they'll be pointing to something else. So for me personally, I don't tend to pay too much attention to the short-term kind of movements. I tend to zoom out. And I think on both ETH and BTC, they look really amazing when you zoom out there. I think ETH, honestly, obviously it has lagged for a little while now, lagged BTC. It usually does do that until later on in the bull market. But I think if you actually look at what ETH is doing, it's consolidating between around 3,600 and 4,000. And I feel like 4,000 just seems to be this like very strong resistance for some reason on ETH. I say for some reason, but I think it's quite obvious why, because if you actually zoom out over multiple years, you can see that 4,000 has always been a tough area for ETH. But I feel like in the new year, things are going to pick back up and ETH will definitely get through that and go on to all-time highs. So yeah, I'm more of a zoom out guy than anything. I mean, anyone who knows me knows that for sure, that I take a very long-term view on these things. So these week-to-week or day-to-day movements definitely don't affect me too much. And I think when it comes to the macro environment with stuff like the Fed, no one's an expert on this. Like, even the macro people who follow this aren't experts. It's very hard to kind of be across all of this stuff. So I honestly don't spend too much time on it myself, because you can make yourself go crazy trying to find a reason, right?
100%. You can make yourself go crazy, and who knows what the Fed is going to do and how that'll affect markets. It did seem, though, in the charts that, you know, the Fed announcement, you know, correlated very closely with this this crypto sell-off. So here's the Fed press conference right here. Mm-hmm. And this is the Bitcoin price charts, about 105K. And then after that conference, you know, Powell, and we're dipping below 100K on Bitcoin. There was Matt Hogan. I always appreciate his takes. They're always like pretty seasoned, pretty rational. He wrote a brief thread on today's move in crypto, the down move, and why he said, "I don't think it alters the bullish trend." I want to hear if you agree with some of this. He said, obviously the big catalyst today was the Fed announcement. We just talked about this. But that being said, he says, the initial pullback wasn't the end of the story. Leverage is a fact in crypto. He points out that some of these sharp pullbacks get amplified in crypto because there's all of these leveraged positions. So this was like a $600 million of leveraged position that just like gets blown out in crypto. And I'm not saying that like leverage is, you know, crypto is the only market to have leverage, but it does have a lot of leverage. The big question, though, is this a hiccup or a reversal? And Matt says it's a hiccup. The reason is because the Fed is not even like relevant to crypto. It's less relevant, at least, than it has been in the past. And he points to these four things that we still have as tailwinds going into 2025. The pro-crypto reversal in DC, rising institutional adoption of ETF flows, which you're going to talk about, Bitcoin purchases by government and corporations, and major breakthroughs in smart contract blockchains, primarily scaling them, right? And this is coming through Ethereum layer twos. So what do you think about that? He says it's just a hiccup. It sounds like you tend to agree.
Yeah, I definitely think so. As I said, like, you can make yourself go crazy looking for different reasons when it comes to the macro stuff. But I agree with Matt here that the Fed macro stuff isn't very relevant to crypto overall. Maybe over the longer term, when you're talking about different kind of assets and their price movements and stuff like that and how that reacts there. But in terms of where crypto is going in 2025 and in terms of what's on the horizon, I completely agree with Matt. There are these massive tailwinds, like the pro-crypto policy in Washington, in DC, and on the political kind of side here is, I think, still way underpriced. I don't think people realize I don't think so. I don't think people realize just how bad it was, especially the last 2 years, and how different it's going to be. There is obviously those kind of doubts from people that say, well, they say it's going to be different, but what if it's the same? And I understand that it's not like a guaranteed thing, but everything that I've seen so far points to it being very different and points to it being a very, very favorable environment for crypto to thrive in. And that will actually lead into the rising institutional adoption, because they'll be able to get involved. They have those regulatory frameworks in place to get involved, which will then translate to more ETF flows. So it does tend to feed on itself, just having this, I guess, clearer guidance and clearer regulation, and a much, I guess, safer is not maybe the right word, but like clearer picture for these institutions to get involved, because they're very risk averse, especially the bigger ones that are managing lots of people's money. They don't want to get involved with something that could bite them in the ass, so to speak, later on. And I think this is what they've been waiting for, just clearer regulations.
Yeah, there's some structural differences this time, particularly in the regulations. I totally agree with that. And also, there's some similarities. I mean, crypto goes in cycles. And I wanted to get your take on this, because another question during weeks like this, people ask themselves, and again, at the end of 2024, starting a new year, 2025, is like, where are we in the cycle? You know, these four-year cycles. Grayscale put together a report here, where here's kind of Bitcoin price over log scale, and they show kind of the cycles. And you can see sort of when the price goes above the line, right? That's like bull cycle. And when it's below the trend line, then you're kind of in the bear cycle, but it tends to follow this long this log trend line. Of course, this is also the, you know, the log line is fitting the data, so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, all of these things. I get that. Here's another chart that's showing Bitcoin price by cycle with the number of days. And so we are how many days in? We are over about 800 days in, something close to that, into the bull cycle. And this dotted line, you can see where we are in the cycle. Basically, their conclusion is we're in kind of the intermediate stage of the cycle. So we're not early in the cycle. We're not late in the bull mania part of the cycle. It's not over. We're in the intermediate phase of the cycle. What's your take on this kind of an analysis and these cycle types of metrics?
Yeah, I mean, this is the classic four-year cycle that crypto has become known for, especially obviously led by Bitcoin, because that's the asset that tends to get us out of the bear markets, tends to run first. You know, Bitcoin dominance goes up and then that liquidity gets, you know, pushed into other assets as time goes on, people can become more risk on, and then we have a full-blown bull market. So I do agree with this analysis that we're pretty much like not at the end yet, but not at the start. We're kind of in the middle, maybe I guess like you could say three quarters of the way through, so to speak, getting to that really crazy phase that I suspect we're going to see in 2025. But again, I think I've mentioned this on the roll-up before and also a lot of times on my own show. This cycle's been a bit weirder than other cycles, I think. You know, we've had weirder price action and different kind of price actions. I mean, BTC went to all-time high before its halvening, and that has never happened before in the four-year cycle. And obviously, this was driven by the ETFs and driven by Saylor as well, doing his big buys and things like that. So there has been differences, but a lot of similarities. So as they say, you know, the history doesn't repeat, but it does often rhyme. And I think that's what we're seeing here. But I think going forward, as the asset class matures, these kind of cycle analysis that people do is going to become less and less reliable, because it'll just become, I guess, more well known, and it won't be as self-fulfilling as it probably has been in the past. And there'll be different, ways to access these assets. Like right now, BTC and ETH have an ETF, but nothing else does. And that tends to distort things, because there's this whole pool of capital that other assets don't have access to that BTC and ETH do. So there are differences, but similarities for sure.
Well, speaking of ETFs, let's look at some Ethereum ETF numbers on the week. And I want you to go full bull mode Anthony Sassano here, because look at all of these. These are the totals from all of December, basically, we're looking at. I'm looking at the Ethereum ETF flows, and this totals column, net inflows, positive, positive, positive. All of the days in December have been positive. Even yesterday, which was like Wednesday, December 18th, at the time of recording, was even a positive day on a sell-off. And this, you know, like in previous months, it looked like the flows weren't actually ETF flows weren't actually coming into ETH, and now suddenly they are. Like it's happening, but later. What do you see when you look at these numbers? And I'll just say for the audience who doesn't have this open, total net inflows right now on the week into the Ethereum ETF. This is a net new institutional buyer of ETH that we haven't had in previous cycles. 2.4 billion. I think that's like between 2 and 3% of all ETH supply here. Anyway, what do you see when you look at these Ethereum ETF numbers?
Yeah, I see a trend shift, to be honest. Like, obviously, I think anyone who's been following along with this stuff since the ETH ETF went live in July knows that it didn't have the start like Bitcoin did, because it launched in a different market conditions. July was still very bearish, whereas the Bitcoin ETF launched right in the middle of a huge uptrend in January of this year. So the ETH ETFs have had a slow start, as we're all pretty much aware of by now. But over the last few weeks, there's been a major trend shift, with the ETH ETFs getting, I think, 40 to 50% on average of BTC's flows, which is higher than its market Crazy. Cap percentage, right? In terms of comparing it to BTC. And I think it hasn't had a negative outflow day since November 21st. So almost a month now of positive inflow days. And as you said, even on the sell-off, we had a positive flow here. So people need to be paying attention to the trend shift that's happening here and how this tends to accelerate as time goes on, especially as price keeps going up. Obviously, these institutions will also get FOMO. It's not just us kind of degen crypto natives that get FOMO. They get FOMO as well. But I think as long as the price is above 3,600, I think all ETF buys are in profit because that's when the ETH ETFs launched. People don't remember this, but ETH went from 3,600 to like 2,000 after the ETH ETFs launched. So there was no appetite to buy an asset that's going down, of course. But now that it's going up, there is an appetite, but there is also a lot more education happening too. I've been hearing that there's a lot more education happening on the institutional side, and that's ramping up as time goes on. So that's being reflected in the flows. But as I said, the main thing here is to notice the trend shift happening and notice that it is a shift that's happened over months now, not just days. And to, I guess, pay attention to this as we head into 2025, because I feel like ETH is going to have a really good year in 2025 and the ETFs are going to be a very big part of that.
Yeah, I think that piece is understated. The amount of education that these issuers, like the BlackRocks of the world, the Fidelities of the world, are like prepping to do and have planned in 2025. That's going to be like, and that's something that Ether the Asset has, struggled with in mainstream, is kind of education, getting institutions to understand it. And they're basically all incented now to help investors understand Ether.
Yes, exactly. And I think a bigger deal is that these institutions traditionally have been selling Ether as, or Ethereum as, like a technology platform, right? Not as a store of value, because they don't want to cannibalize the BTC ETFs. And I think that obviously within crypto, we know that ETH is a money, is a store of value. People treat it like this. And I think that's going to slowly bleed into the sales pitch that these institutions use. But they're going to start with the tech pitch first, because that's what resonates most, I think, with these investors after they've just heard about the money and store of value pitch for BTC. But I do think that it's inevitable that the Ether's money store of value story gets woven into the tech story as well. And that's definitely going to help flows.
Do you know what I think is going to be a narrative that's like the institutions aren't ready for, but I think it's going to be pretty exciting for those of us who think Ether is a phenomenal store of value? I just did a AI roll-up with Ejaz, where we just kind of recap the AI type agent type news on the week. And we talked about an AI agent called Zero Bro, earned a whole bunch of fees through trading, earned money through trading, through Spotify streams, all of these things. And you know what it did with those funds, Anthony, is it took that fiat and all those token fees, and it actually purchased Ether, the asset, and it spun up a validator, okay, in order so it could have passive income, okay? So the big question is, what's the store of value for these new economic players, AI agents? Is it going to be fiat? Is it going to be stocks? Is it going to be real estate? Or is it going to be a programmable non-sovereign money like Ether that generates passive income? It's kind of like the internet bond type story here. And that's how Zero Bro is treating it. Anyway, emerging story, that kind of thing. But like they're a new economic actor, and what they determine as money and how they store their value is actually going to factor in here and matter. One topic I have for you in the realm of non-institutional assets, though, but also links with AI agents, is a Fartcoin. Like, what the hell, man? I have not, like, okay, this is, there's an actual token called Fartcoin. It's been moving a crazy amount. It's up 27% on the week. Started in November, it was like 18 million. And now it's, fully diluted, over $1 billion. And its genesis was really another AI agent, like a token terminal type thing. And, token terminal, if people are following that story, created but popularized a coin called GOAT. Token terminal is an LLM. Anyway, it's sort of, Token Terminal has adopted Fartcoin as like its mimetic, token of value. And look at the price ascent here. What do you think of these types of shenanigans that are going on? What's your take here?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to these sorts of things, it's always hard to pick winners. Like you look at this right now and you think to yourself, okay, well, this has done really well price action wise. It obviously right now it's at all time high and everyone's made money that has bought it and everything. But then there is usually a graveyard of other assets, like millions of these things that go absolutely nowhere. So really what the meme coin and AI coin game becomes is a game of attention. Like, where can you direct people's attention to? And that's what coins usually tend to particularly do well and get outsized attention, outsized price movement. And usually how that attention was given was via humans. Like there'll be some influencer on Twitter that says, I bought this meme coin. I think it's going to go up for such and such reason. Go buy this. But now we're entering the realm where these AI agents are doing that themselves. It's not just the humans. It's the AI saying, well, I like this meme coin for such and such reason, and this is the one I've chosen. So people are now following that. So it really is, it's the same kind of concept, but with an autonomous agent instead of a human doing it. And it starts to get weird when you consider the, I guess, incentive here, where you can say, well, there is an identity attached to this AI agent, but at the same time, I know it's not a real person. I know it's not a human. So I can trust it potentially more than a human because I can actually see what it's doing on chain. Whereas a lot of these humans that promote these things, they've got backroom deals going on. They've got insider stuff going on. They're part of a cabal. AI agents can do this too. But if they're doing everything on chain from a public address, then it becomes a bit more transparent, I think. But at the same time, it's still fundamentally the same concept of attention economy, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Attention economy. What we're looking at here is, to your point, is you can see inside of the AI's brain. So this is infinite back rooms. If you do a search for fart, right? This is where a token terminal is literally dreaming up the idea of, hey, we should do a fart coin and airdrop it and instantiating it. So you can literally read the transaction logs of what it's thinking. Anyway, bizarre stuff. In contrast to the institutions where we're like, hey, Bitcoin and Ether, they're serious asset classes. And then we have fart coin trading over $1 billion. One last thing on the week that I noticed on the from the Fed FOMC meeting, somebody asked Jerome Powell about a federal strategic Bitcoin reserve. Of course, that's been a Trump talking point lately. And he said this from the Fed's perspective, Jerome Powell, we're not allowed to own Bitcoin, he said. And he was asked a follow-up question in terms of like legal issues, like, is it illegal even for the Fed to own Bitcoin? And he said, that's the kind of thing for Congress to consider, but we are not looking for a law change at the Fed. I don't think Powell or the Fed actually wants to own Bitcoin. And there's a question as to whether, you know, Trump or Congress kind of like forced them into it or forced the rest of the U.S. Government into owning some Bitcoin. What's your take on the strategic reserve? Are you like in 2025 over under on the probability that, Trump does something or the U.S. government does something here? Do you think it'll happen?
I think they'll try to do something and they'll talk about it a lot and try to get things kind of passed or pushed through. I don't think it'll happen in 2025, to be honest. I think that people underestimate how difficult it is to actually make this happen. It's not like Trump can just like wave a wand and make it happen. He has to go through all the bureaucratic stuff to do this. And he's not like some God king who can just make anything happen, especially when it comes to the money. Like it's a very different game when you're playing that game. So I think maybe potentially it can happen eventually. But I've been following it and all I'm seeing is a lot of talk with not much action yet, obviously, because there can't be action until at least the inauguration happens and Trump's actually got in power and everything kind of changes over. But I feel like it should happen because I do agree that it is a strategic importance for nation states to own these assets. I believe that they're better off owning ETH than BTC. I believe ETH is a more strategically important asset, of course. But I think both of them hold their own importance for different reasons. And I think that you've already seen smaller nation states around the world, buy BTC. I think some of them even bought ETH or are going to or have plans to. So eventually I can see the US doing it. But yeah, I don't know if it'll happen in 2025. There'll be a lot of talk about it, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, the one thing that Trump might be able to do, it's unclear to me, is just keep the Bitcoin and other crypto assets that they have already, that they've already seized. Whether you consider that a strategic Bitcoin reserve or not, I guess is semantics. I think buying more might be a little bit of a higher bar. I did point out, by the way, that China has like something like 10x the amount of Ether versus the U.S. government. So, I don't know if Trump wants to play for second place or if he wants to play for first place, but you better boost those Ether bags. And you can see him doing that in World Liberty Financial, his little DeFi outlet. We'll talk about that later. A lot more to talk about, too, including, Anthony, I want to get your take on the developer report. So we got some big insights from a 2024 developer report. Also, Kraken's Ink Chain. We'll get into that. It's a new layer, too, of course. And an update on a vote in Congress for the very last remaining anti-crypto SEC commissioner. There's still one of them. Is she going to be there come January or not? We'll talk about all of that and more. But before we do, I want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible, including our recommended exchange for 2024. That is Kraken. It's almost the end of the year. Go create an account.
Want to know the exchange we at Bankless use to buy, sell, and trade crypto? It's Kraken, one of the longest standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world, with tools for every type of trader to get started. Over 13 million users trust Kraken with their funds because they lead with transparency and privacy through top-notch security measures. Plus, they'll have access to professional 24/7, 365 client support from real humans because your financial goals deserve real attention. Kraken also has a trading platform for advanced traders called Kraken Pro. Professionals and degens love Kraken Pro because it's one of the most customizable, high-performance, and intuitive trading platforms in the industry. Design your ultimate trading interface by choosing from over 25 widgets for market data, analysis, execution, and other order management tools. Save multiple layouts and switch between them effortlessly on any trading scenario across 300 different assets. Manage your trades on the go with Kraken Pro's highly rated mobile app, or use the all-new desktop app to unlock ladder trading in a native Rust application. With Kraken Pro, you can truly trade like a pro. Ready to take control over your crypto journey? Visit kraken.com/bankless to get started today. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss and is offered to U.S. customers through Payward Interactive, Inc. View legal disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures. Are you ready to take control over your entire financial life? Crypto, DeFi, and fiat all in one place? Meet iYield, the free financial planning tool built for crypto natives. Unlike traditional portfolio trackers that just show you the value of your assets, iYield goes deeper. It consolidates everything: assets, debts, income, and expenses, offering you a complete financial picture across 16,000 tokens, 40 DeFi protocols, and all fiat currencies. With real-time DeFi yield tracking for platforms like Aave, Athena, Eigenlayer, and Uniswap, iYield ensures that you're always on top of your staking rewards, investments, and cash flow. And the best part? It's 100% free with no ads, and it's secure. No personal data, no ID requirements, no compromises. So head over to iYield.com to sign up today and get the guesswork out of financial planning. The Arbitrum portal is your one-stop hub to entering the Ethereum ecosystem. With over 800 apps, Arbitrum offers something for everyone. Dive into the epicenter of DeFi, where advanced trading, lending, and staking platforms are redefining how we interact with money. Explore Arbitrum's rapidly growing gaming hub, from immersed role-playing games, fast-paced fantasy MMOs, to casual luck battle mobile games. Move assets effortlessly between chains and access the ecosystem with ease via Arbitrum's expansive network of bridges and on-ramps. Step into Arbitrum's flourishing NFT and creator space, where artists, collectors, and social converge, and support your favorite streamers all on-chain. Find new and trending apps and learn how to earn rewards across the Arbitrum ecosystem with limited time campaigns from your favorite projects. Empower your future with Arbitrum. Visit portal.arbitrum.io to find out what's next on your Web3 journey.
All right, Anthony, it's all about the developers. You know, Steve Ballmer, developers, 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 developers. So every year, Electric Capital puts together their annual developer report. And my take on developers is they're sort of like entrepreneurs. You know how regular nation state economies, they'll do reports on how many small businesses started in a given year, or like, you know, what's the kind of the company activity of all of the startups. Well, this is a similar type of thing. I think it's a leading indicator for the crypto economy. So like, developer number go up, that's a good thing. That means more entrepreneurs, that means more businesses on chain. So Electric Capital analyzes like a whole bunch of GitHub repositories, 1.7 million repositories apparently, and it produces this report at the end of the year. So a few things to look into. The number one is this chart. You see in this? So this is crypto developers grew 39% per year since 2015. And you can see kind of this chart up. It's not a vertical lineup of interest, right? It's kind of like, it's kind of bumpy. Mm-hmm. When you see something like this and 39% per year since 2015, we're at the end destination right now. As of November 2024, we have 23,000. So there's part of me where I'm like, I'm impressed at the, you know, 40% annual growth rate, but also look, there's only like 23,000. I mean, that's a small town. There's not a lot of developers yet in crypto. What's your take on these numbers?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. It's not that many yet. I mean, obviously the growth is great to see and it's up and up, but in compared to the rest of the software development world and all the other developers out there, there are hundreds of millions of developers in the world, I believe. So this is a drop in the bucket. and we have a lot more people left to onboard. And I think we're going to keep doing that as time goes on. I don't think this is going to slow down. Obviously, there's bumps along the way. A lot of these bumps tend to be correlated with price action. Obviously, as prices go up, you know, things tend to get hotter. People, developers, just like everyday regular people, follow the money as well. If you're getting, you know, a higher salary working in crypto and you've got the skills to do it, you're going to go work in crypto. And then if there's a downturn and you get laid off because the company you're working for doesn't have much money anymore and you go work somewhere else. So it's the same kind of story here, and you follow that boom and bust, but the trend is up. That's what we care about. That's what we care about in all, I guess, aspects of crypto. As long as the trend is up, we're doing something right.
The trend is up, but not in all places. Actually, the trend is down in North America. So maybe this was the hostile regulatory environment. But look at North America. It used to be the leader in terms of crypto developer share, market share, that is, and it's dipped below two other continents, both Asia and Europe. So now North America is number three and has been bypassed by Asia and Europe. I think that's the whole like Gensler anti-crypto army effect. Yeah, yep. You agree?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Like, as I think I said earlier, the last 2 years specifically have been really, really bad. A lot of different crypto entrepreneurs, developers have either moved their business offshore if they were based in North America or just not started anything in North America at all because they're like, well, it's a hostile environment. I'm not going to go there. You know, if you're a sheep, you don't go into the lion's den expecting to be treated
fairly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So, or the wolves den, I should say. But yeah, so I feel like if we get the positive regulatory change in 2025, North America should go back up in the next report that we see from Electric Capital at the end of next year.
From an ecosystem perspective, Ethereum was leading on every continent. Solana was like number two, and then there was some of the other ones, Bitcoin, etc. A couple of my takeaways is it's sort of interesting to see the differences between these chains. So this is a chart of total value locked, where Ethereum is like absolutely dominant. Like nothing else is close, not even kind of the layer twos. So a lot of the kind of total capital locked up is on Ethereum, whereas you know, Solana has had an increase in terms of transactions, like number of transactions and like exchange volume and that kind of thing. They're actually quite impressive on that dimension. So there's some differences between the markets. A lot of people pointed out, though, this, Anthony, I wanted to get your take. So this is a chart of the number of new developers in the ecosystem in 2024. And Solana, for the first time, this was the headline chart, Solana for the first time was ahead of Ethereum in terms of attracting new developers. Now, there's a few footnotes to this. If you include Ethereum plus like you add, you know, Base and plus you add Arbitrum, Optimism, other layer twos, Ethereum is still ahead on net new developers. It's also the fact that like net new developers don't tend to stay. So, you know, there's kind of the tourists and the settlers, right? And anytime you get net new developers, 80%, like 80% of them are likely to leave, according to some of the stats, and only a few sort of stay. So they're less valuable than the veterans when it comes to staying powers, but still pretty impressive in terms of attracting new developers. What's your take there as an ETH bull?
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that obviously Solana had a big year in 2024, right? It grew a lot. The price of the token went up a lot, which created a wealth effect around the ecosystem, which tends to draw people in, both users and developers alike. As I said earlier, users, people, regular people, developers, they're all attracted to the same thing, which is money. You go where the money is, you explore new frontiers, you explore new kind of places to generate wealth. And I think that's exactly what happened here. As I said, Solana had a wealth effect. Developers came in. They're like, what's this Solana thing? I haven't tried it before, because it says new developers, right? So it's like, okay, well, I haven't tried Solana before. Maybe they've tried the EVM before. You've been able to build on the EVM for a very long time now, which includes Ethereum, its L2s, and also other L1s, right? There are many other L1s out there that are also EVM. But Solana is different. Solana is SVM. They have their own virtual machine that they use. So it's a different environment altogether. So if you had been on the fence about it until this year, and you saw all this activity happening there, you're naturally going to be like, well, let's see what I can build on there. What's the developer experience like? I want to check this out. I want to see what's going on over here. So I think that it's natural for this to happen. And I think that it's obviously impressive as well. Like kudos to Solana for this. But as you pointed out as well, Ethereum is still huge, right? Ethereum still has plenty of developers on there, both at layer one and layer twos. And that shows no signs of slowing down either. There was actually a good thread from Josh Stark that pointed out from this this report all the Ethereum related stuff, and Ethereum still dominates across pretty much everything else. Like, not the new developer strategy you just showed, but for the reasons I explained, but across everything else, Ethereum still dominates. And it dominates, I think, where it matters as well. You mentioned TVL. That is a huge thing. People tend to underrate it, but I think that it is something that is not rated highly enough, because it really does show where, like, the big capital likes to be and likes to stay. And even though there are other ecosystems, most of the money stays on Ethereum L1 because, I mean, they're probably fee insensitive users, obviously, because fees are higher there, you have to be. But also, you trust Ethereum L1 not to go offline, you know, trust it to be secure and resilient and decentralized. And you trust that there aren't going to be changes made to the network that's going to cause things to go wrong for you and your assets. And obviously, a lot of the DeFi protocols on there are extremely battle tested at this point and hardened, like Aave, for example, like Uniswap on there, been around for a long time. So I think that's what you're seeing there. But I feel like as the Ethereum community or Ethereum ecosystem continues to modularize, you're going to see more of a split here as well, because Ethereum also has layer twos that are not EVM going forward as well, that are going to be launching. I mean, Eclipse is already live. That's using the SVM. There's Fluent coming along that's going to be doing a bunch of blended execution stuff with WASM, things like that. Fuel just launched one with a similar architecture to what Bitcoin uses, UTXO architecture, with their Fuel VM. So there's just a kind of modularization pattern happening too. So I do hope that the Electric Capital report can highlight that and kind of dig into the intricacies of that in their next report, because that's what it's going to be like going forward for the Ethereum ecosystem.
Well, speaking of all the Ethereum modules there, there's certainly a lot of layer twos that have launched, and one of which just launched this week. This was kind of a little bit of a surprise, I think, for a lot of people in crypto, because this is the Kraken Inc. launch. Okay, so Inc. is a layer two. It's built on the Optimism stack, so similar in some respects to what we've seen from Base, which has chosen a similar framework. And it seemed like Kraken just like launched this ahead of schedule. I mean, they had announced that they were going to launch it, I think, about 6 weeks ago or something like this. And now here it is. It's live on mainnet this week. And people who are listening to this can go check out the Ink chain. I've got here a dashboard, a list of kind of all of the apps, and it's everything you'd come to expect. You know, you've got like things like Curve down here. You've got like Frax on there. You've, of course, have the Kraken wallet support and everything that is you'd see in another optimistic rollup EVM type chain. What's the significance of Kraken, another major exchange, probably the one of the top exchanges in the world right now, launching its layer two and doing this on the back of a very successful Base program from Coinbase? What do you think this means?
It just continues the trend of everyone wanting to be on chain, right? And they want to be on chain in their own way. They want to kind of create something that reflects their brand identity. And that's exactly what Kraken has done with Ink. That's what Coinbase has done with Base. There's others out there as well. You can go down the list on L2 Beat and check out each of them for yourself. But they all have their own ecosystem, brand, community identity that they try to build. Ink seems to be trying to build its kind of branding and ecosystem around, I guess, degen first, right? Like very degen kind of stuff first, like getting into the meme coin stuff. I know they had like one of the Giga Chad kind of faces on their website, like stuff like that, right? Whereas when Base initially started, they were going hard on things like SocialFi, for example, and they had Farcaster on board there and things like that. And they've kind of shifted over time. But yeah, it's all about creating that new kind of, I guess, on-chain identity for these organizations here. So overall, I think it's really bullish that these organizations get to do this, because you can imagine a world where there wasn't L2s. It was just one layer. Like Ethereum was just one layer. There wasn't L2s out there. These brands wouldn't have built an L2, obviously, and then they really to come on chain would probably have a harder time doing that, because they'd maybe just create some kind of, I guess, like app on Ethereum instead of a whole L2 ecosystem and try to build an ecosystem around that. So it does become more kind of difficult there. So I'm excited to see this go live ahead of schedule. I know that the Kraken guys have been working on this for quite a while now. And I really do like this dashboard that you have up on your screen, because it shows you exactly what you can do straight away. You know, there's no need to ask, oh, what do I do on Ink? It's like, here's what you do on Ink. Here's all the apps. Here's how you bridge in. Here's the infrastructure support we have right now. Here's how you on-ramp. Because that's what we need to see going forward, because there's no use putting something out there and being like, okay, well, we're live. Oh, and people come along and go, oh, okay, you're live. What do I do on your chain? So I'm glad that they've done this. This is actually a really cool thing to see. But I think that going forward, you're going to see these chains launch faster and faster as the infrastructure matures as well, and it becomes easier to launch these things. And you're going to see other companies around the world doing this. And I'm sure we're going to talk about one of them, as you mentioned, a big bank that's doing this as well.
Oh, let's talk about that next, because what we've seen, of course, is all of the what we call on Bankless sometimes crypto banks, but what we mean is exchanges that are custodying crypto. They all have layer two strategies right now, almost all of them, except for like Binance, which has its own like, you know, layer one strategy with the BNB chain. The question is, what's the next kind of like group to start launching chains? And the answer to that question might be like TradFi banks, actual traditional banks. So Deutsche Bank is a $1.5 trillion bank. It's Germany's largest bank. And just this week, they announced that they were launching an Ethereum L2, not just any Ethereum L2, a ZK Sync L2. So it's a ZK EVM on top of Ethereum. Here's the headline here. Deutsche Bank, valued at $1.5 trillion, Germany's largest, is developing a layer 2 blockchain on Ethereum. Are we just going to get all of the banks to launch L2s as well? Is that how this works? They just like port all of their ledgers and their assets over?
I mean, if they want to, they can. That's the beauty of it, right? No one's stopping them from building these things on Ethereum, because Ethereum is credibly neutral and decentralized. It will not stop you from doing this. And I think that you can see on the headline here, it says it's going to have regulatory oversight, and people will maybe balk at that and say, oh, you know, this is just like another centralized thing from a bank. It's like, yeah, but the point is that they're using crypto rails. They're coming on chain. They're going to interoperate with the wider on-chain economy. And if you don't want to use this, you don't have to. You have the entire decentralized on-chain economy to access. But they're saying, well, I want to access that too. I want to be involved with this too. And that's why I think that they're doing this. And one of my dream things to see in crypto, and one thing that I've been speculating about for a little while now, is an entity like BlackRock coming along and launching their new stock exchange that they want to launch as a layer two on Ethereum, using real-world assets that they've tokenized, like stocks and bonds and all that, and doing that there. That, to me, would be the holy grail, because all of a sudden, if BlackRock was to do that, you would see an absolute flood of all of these banks and companies coming in and building their own L2s here, which obviously strengthens Ethereum beyond words, I think. Even though these are centralized entities, it basically says to the world, Ethereum is the place that we're building. Just like when, like a nation state comes up, like America, for example, all the businesses went there and said, I'm building in America because of such and such reason. People are coming to Ethereum and saying, I'm building in Ethereum. I'm building my ecosystem on Ethereum because that is the obvious place to build.
Oh my God. Do you know something about BlackRock, Anthony?
No, I don't have any insider. It's something that myself and others have speculated, but that's the thing. I think that's the point. You can see it, right? There is a path to that actually becoming a reality.
Yeah, my take was when BlackRock launched the Biddle Fund, which has been a massive success on Ethereum. This is their tokenized treasury assets. And now, by the way, there's some news later in the episode where they're integrating into all of these other DeFi protocols. My take was that, okay, that's the first BlackRock bank branch on Ethereum. They just like opened up shop on Ethereum. And it totally makes sense that they would expand and eventually become a layer two. So let's see what they have in mind. Anthony, I don't know if you've been following this, but we have one remaining SEC commissioner that's part of the Gary Gensler anti-crypto army. Her name is Caroline Crenshaw. And we just an update on this, because she was supposed to go up for vote in Congress this week to be renewed another tenure. And of course, the crypto community pushed back against this. We don't want more Gensler style commissioners that are like super anti-crypto. An update on this: she was up for vote this week, and what happened? The vote was canceled. And what I think this might mean is it's likely that she's going to be out, because we are running out of time for her to get the votes in the Democratic controlled Congress to actually vote her in. And in January, this all flips to Republican, of course. So that's kind of crazy. And it's also crazy because it's another extension of the story of crypto advocacy in DC. This is Stand With Crypto, you know, also part of kind of like, you know, the PAC. They had crypto advocates send over 100,000 emails to U.S. senators about a regulator, about Caroline Crenshaw, saying, like, don't reconfirm her. Like, crypto is watching your votes, members of Congress. And if you vote yes, that is an anti-crypto vote. I think the a big story coming out of 2024 is just, like, the political willpower of the pro-crypto army, which it seems like is composed by a lot of single-issue voters, crypto zealots, a lot of capital, of course, industry support, all of these things. But it's like a force in Congress. We may be down to like zero anti-crypto like commissioners going into 2025. And that's absolutely crazy.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that if you look at all of the stuff that's happened over the last couple of years as well on this front, the SEC is at the forefront of being the worst actor in the crypto ecosystem on the regulator side of things, for sure. So having a positive SEC going forward, like once the inauguration happens and everything changes over, that's going to be a huge boon to crypto, I think. So we're definitely going to have a pro-crypto SEC finally, like after so long. It feels like we've been waiting forever for this, but we're finally going to have that. And, you know, I think it's funny because I think most people would settle for just an SEC that actually plays by the rules. People don't realize
100%.
That the, you know what I mean? It's not about being pro yeah. anti-crypto. It's just we want a regulator that follows the rules that they're yeah. supposed to follow.
I mean, that was basically Hester Peirce. I mean, she was just like open to it. She wasn't just like, oh, I support everything. You know, God bless. All of your tokens are none of them are security. She wasn't like that. She was just like, why don't we create a sandbox? Why don't we just mm-hmm. not stop this innovation in the U.S.? It was totally reasonable. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's not even pro-crypto. It's just like neutral. We just don't want anti-crypto. Actually, last thing on politics before we leave this section, Congressman French Hill, which has been on the Bankless podcast. He's a congressman. He has been nominated to chair the House Financial Services Committee. It's a very big role in Congress. He is definitely pro-crypto. And he got that nod this week, too. So big news on that. Anthony, we got a lot more to talk about, including Athena. They introduced a stablecoin backed by, what were we just talking about, BlackRock, the BlackRock Biddle Fund. What does that mean? Also, there's some Aave versus Polygon drama, DeFi drama that I want to get your take on, all this and more. But before we do that, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
With over $1.5 billion in TVL, the METH protocol is home to METH, the fourth largest ETH liquid staking token, offering one of the highest APRs among the top 10 LSTs. And now, CMETH takes things even further. This restaked version captures multiple yields across Kerak, Eigenlayer, Symbiotic, and many more, making CMETH the most efficient and most composable LRT solution on the market. Metamorphosis Season 1 dropped $7.7 million in Cook rewards to METH holders. Season 2 is currently ongoing, allowing users to earn staking, restaking, and AVS yields, plus rewards in Cook, METH Protocol's governance token, and more. Don't miss out on the opportunity to stake, restake, and shape the future of METH Protocol with Cook. Participate today at meth.mantle.xyz. Uniswap Labs is making history with the largest bug bounty ever. $15.5 million for critical bugs found in Uniswap V4. This isn't just any update. Uniswap V4 is built with hundreds of contributions from community developers and has already undergone 9 independent audits, making it one of the most rigorously reviewed code bases to be deployed on-chain. And with 2.4 trillion in cumulative volume processed across Uniswap V2 and V3 without a single hack, the commitment to security and transparency is rock solid. Now Uniswap Labs is taking an extra step to make V4 as secure as possible with a $15.5 million bug bounty. Head to the link in the show notes to dive in and participate in the Uniswap V4 bug bounty. All the details, from eligibility and scope to the rewards, are there. Are you looking to pay your team in stablecoins or set up token grants with ease? Traditional payroll providers aren't designed for crypto. Handling tax withholdings, government reporting, and local filings for tokens can be a nightmare. With Toku, everything about global token compensation gets simpler. Whether it's paying full-time employees in stablecoins, managing token grant administration, or even navigating the TGE process, Token covers over 100 countries on one seamless platform. Integrate Toku with your current payroll system or choose a fully managed service. Either way, Toku simplifies every part of token compensation. However you work, Toku works for you. No guesswork, no missed deadlines, no complexity. Visit toku.com. That's T-O-K-U.com to talk with Toku today.
All right, Anthony, have you been following the Aave versus Polygon drama? I'm not sure what the lessons are from this, if this is a lesson in risk, a lesson in governance. Like, how would you summarize this?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since we've had some serious DeFi drama, I think, within Ethereum. So it was quite entertaining to follow along with this, if I say so myself. But I think if we zoom out a little bit and focus on what was actually being debated here. So essentially, there was a proposal put forward by a bunch of projects within the Polygon ecosystem that wanted to use the bridged funds, so the funds that were bridged into Polygon, and put them to work, essentially. Because right now, they're just sitting in the bridge. These projects were like, hey, we can use these stable coins to earn a yield. And we're leaving like $70 million a year on the table by not doing this. And then, of course, there was a whole debate kicked up about this once people started paying attention to it, saying, well, that's really risky. What if something happens to those assets? Then the assets that were bridged over aren't backed by anything anymore and essentially can become worthless. And we've seen all these bridge hacks over the years, and it's really ugly. They're huge honeypots, so on and so forth. It also breaks the kind of social contract you have with users that you won't use their bridge assets to do other things, and so on and so forth. So ultimately, the proposal was shot down, and it's not going to be going ahead right now. But the drama, I think, stemmed from a bunch of community members or a bunch of people within the Aave and Polygon ecosystems having a bit of, I guess, like, I don't know if I'd call it personal attacks, but more of like personal drama where they said, oh, yeah, he said, she said kind of thing. That's what blew out the drama, I think. But the actual proposal itself, yeah, there was debate around that. But then there was also debate around the interpersonal drama that stemmed from that.
Yeah, okay. So I haven't been watching this up close, but I've sort of seen some of it. And I guess my take is, so there's this proposal, as you said, to take bridge assets and do something else with it, like put it in Morpho and Yield or something like that, or mm-hmm. Morpho and Urine, get some additional yield on that. Like my take on that is like, oh, that sounds like a really bad idea because, mm-hmm. you know, none of the users who bridge their assets, you haven't consented with any of them. And mm-hmm. what we're doing is like, it's almost like rehypothecation, right? We're stacking risk on top of risk. So like at the outset, I don't like proposals like this. Doesn't sound like a great idea. However, it's just a proposal. Like it's mm-hmm. not, it hasn't happened yet. Open governance forums, proposals are messy. And then what I saw is some members of the Aave community submitted their own proposal, which is basically like, if you do this, we're going to deactivate Aave on Polygon, basically set parameters to zero in their risk models so that nothing on Poly. And so, and then Polygon reacted to that and some of the, you know, founders, Sandeep, et cetera, and said, wait, okay, hold on. This is just a proposal. Mm-hmm. You're like, why are you exiting? Maybe you're doing this for your own reasons, Aave, and you secretly wanted to use like the bridged assets for something.
Yeah, I mean,
Aave.
That's the point, right? One of the projects that proposed this was Morpho, which is a direct competitor to Aave. So that's where a lot of the drama stemmed from as well. It's like this conflict of interests, yeah. I guess, and competitive stuff.
Yeah, and then so there was some Sandeep from Polygon and Stani from Aave, like back and forth, and you know, I think Stani was saying like, well, what are you guys getting from the Morpho community? Are you getting token incentives? Anyway, some messiness, some mudslinging. What did we learn from this other than like some of this all of this happens in the open, such is the nature of DeFi. So this is probably not the last time that we'll see like a blow up from this. What else did we learn?
Yeah, I mean, I think from some of the discussions that I saw that fell out of this, just regardless of the projects involved, it was discussions around using bridged assets in other ways. Like that's been a big discussion for a while. I know there are some like layer twos, for example, like Blast and Mantle that will tell you we're going to use your bridged assets to do things. Like they just put the ETH into Lido and stake their ETH and earn a yield on that. But they tell the users up front that they're going to do that. There is no kind of like after the fact usage of assets once they're bridged in. So I fall more in that camp. As long as you let the people know that, hey, your assets are actually going to get used if you bridge into our L2 or use our protocol, whatever it is, then that to me is fine. It's when, yeah, you do it after the fact where you've bridged in all this money, like billions of dollars of capital. And then you say, well, it's just sitting there right now. Why don't we use it for something? That's where things get very murky. So I think that we're going to be having more and more debates over the coming months about this, because there is a lot of money in these bridges that is doing nothing right now. And as that grows, it's going to become more and more tempting to put that to work to earn yield and to kick that back to users as well in order to get more users on your platform, especially when it comes to the L2s competing for users. This could be something that they use to essentially even offer free fees. Even though the fees are low, they could offer free fees because they could earn that yield and then kick that back to users as subsidization for fees. So there is going to be a lot of more discussion around that. But in terms of the other major lesson as well is the fact that these protocols compete with each other. People tend to forget this, but they compete with each other, and it's cutthroat competition too, because it's all out in the open, as you said. So we're going to see more of this drama unfold as protocols start juicing incentives for these things. Says, hey, why don't you use your bridged assets in our protocol and we'll put some nice token incentives on top as well. And then you're going to get the users saying, well, I want those token incentives, so I want you guys to use the bridged assets. And then you're going to see capital flow around like that and projects fight with each other over users and so on and so forth. So I think this is really only the beginning of what we're going to see around using bridged assets for different things, but there's going to be lots of drama as well.
Okay, so I totally agree with you about informed consent. And for anyone who's looking at this and like being like, oh, this is terrible. Like, I don't like it. You're watching how the sausage is made. And what I would remind everyone listening to is banks do this all of the time, except it's completely closed. They don't talk about it. They don't ask anyone's permission. They don't like, they just rehypothecate, okay? And there's no accountability because none of it's on chain. So you have no idea what's actually going on. So these types of conversations actually, and kind of the back and forth of it, and even the competing for users here and the competitive pressures, it's good for us. It's good for DeFi users, okay? Because it's open, it's transparent. You go right click view source in the code to see where the assets are, you know, what the risk profile is and all of that, and that you can't get in traditional finance. So I think it's like, in that way, it's like bullish, even though it just looks a little bit, mudslingy. Yeah. Pudgy Penguins launched their Pengu token. 7 million addresses were eligible, a whole bunch of ETH addresses, a whole bunch of Solana addresses as well. This is what the token is doing, Anthony. So almost a $2 billion market cap. What does this remind you of? Okay, so like it feels like I'm getting flashbacks to Bored Apes and... They launched a coin. Am I right about that? I'm pretty certain they did at some point in the cycle. And it did something like this, multi-billion-dollar valuation. Are you getting flashbacks to that?
I mean, they launched a different timing in the market. I believe they launched in 2022, which was obviously the bear market. Like, crypto had already topped in 2021, whereas Pudgy Penguin seems to be launching at least halfway through the bull market. But the price action is interesting to see because... there was another airdrop a few weeks ago, or maybe a month or two ago, called Hyperliquid that happened. And then it went up only after the airdrop, right? But with Pudgy Penguins, it has gone, I believe, like mostly down only since it launched, basically, a few days ago. And obviously the Pudgy NFTs, for anyone who saw, they also dumped, I think, 50 to 60% because people were buying those NFTs in order to farm the token. And then as soon as you got the token, that was baked into the price of the NFT. The ARB was done. Everyone sold the NFTs. So what kind of happened is that there was a ton of hype. The broader market sold off. You know, the NFTs sold off because that ARB closed, and then the token just is already worth, a fair bit right now. So it's kind of plateaued of where it is. So I don't have any opinions of where it's going to go from here. I don't know much about the Pudgy ecosystem. I'm not a bull or bear on it. I'm relatively neutral on it. But I don't think it is that comparable to what happened with Apes, because it was a different timing in the market. And also, I think from what I've seen, the Pudgy Penguin ecosystem is doing a lot more than the Bored Ape ecosystem is doing right now. And they've branched out and doing a bunch of different things. They've got their own layer two coming out with Abstract. You know, I don't think it's like the Pudgy L2, but they're working very closely with it to launch that. So they're doing a lot of different things. So I respect the building that's going on there. But yeah, the token, I mean, who knows? I think they even called it a meme coin themselves. So we'll see.
Yeah, fair enough. It's just another meme coin. I do really respect Luca and his ability to execute. He basically brought Pudgy's back from the dead. And you're right around this ARB opportunity. So Pudgy's has been up from the NFT perspective, and now it's like it was down on the week because everyone sort of got the proceeds from this. You know, one other dimension that's different than Bored Apes or anything that we've seen before is actually there's actual Pudgy Penguin toys in stores. And so what's happening is Pudgy Penguin's toys were sold with a QR code that entitled you to Pengu airdrop. So what's been happening, Anthony, in stores like all around, I guess the world, is people are like, ripping open the package and yoinking the QR code in order to be eligible for that airdrop. They're just like, here's a package of Pudgy Penguins. You know, they left the stuffed animal, but they ripped off the QR code in order to be eligible for that airdrop. So some weird incentives when it comes to airdropping physical products.
Yeah. And this is funny because we like I pay attention to like the trading card game kind of arena.
I collect
Pokemon cards and stuff like that. And this was happening with Pokemon cards where people would go in, open packs, collect the rare cards and then resell them on eBay or whatever. And then they had to end up locking up all the cards behind glass. Imagine seeing these Pudgy Penguins locked up behind glass and you have to go to the teller and ask, hey, can I get one of the Pudgy plushies, please?
Yeah.
This is what happens in America, when you can
buy the guns, right? They're not locked up, but like the Pudgy Penguins are locked up behind the glass.
Can I speak
to a manager? Show your ID, sir. All right, so that's the Pudgy story on the weekend. And by the way, go check if you're eligible for this. A whole bunch of wallet addresses are eligible for this, so you might be as well. At Bankless Claimables, you can do that. Athena launched a new stablecoin, Anthony, on BlackRock's Biddle Fund. This was kind of new. So they have a stablecoin, of course, that works on sort of the ARB type trade, the carry type trade between the kind of the price of ETH and the price of fiat, and works with centralized exchanges. They've launched a different stablecoin though that is different. It's called USBTB, and it has a different yield source, a different backing, a different collateral base, and that collateral base is all BlackRock treasuries. It's all the Biddle Fund. So this is an example, I think, of BlackRock really expanding into DeFi. So it's like, Athena's like less than maybe it's a year or two old. It's pretty new. It's all DeFi. It's all cutting edge. And this is BlackRock like striking a deal with them and really expanding. They would just want Biddle to go everywhere in the crypto economy, it seems, and they're willing to partner with just about everybody. What do you make of this? The partnership between BlackRock and a DeFi protocol, Athena?
Yeah, I mean, for such a large organization, BlackRock being the largest asset manager in the world, the fact that they're this forward-looking and this fast-moving with coming on-chain is pretty staggering. As you mentioned, Athena is not an old protocol. It is relatively new, and they're already working with BlackRock, and BlackRock is already working with them, and it seems like this is just the very beginning of BlackRock's plans. They probably have some very ambitious plans of what to do on chain. And that's why I mentioned earlier where I do see a reality where they launch their own L2, which gives them the control and the ability to come on chain in the biggest way possible and to interoperate with the rest of the on chain economy. And they are a fee insensitive user as well. So they wouldn't necessarily be launching the L2 for, I guess, scalability purposes. It would be more probably to be able to onboard a bunch of different things, a bunch of different real world assets, which is what they're mainly focused on. Larry Fink always talks about tokenization of real world assets. So bringing all of that on chain and interoperating with the wider Ethereum on chain economy is just such a thing that I see them doing. And it would be such a massive unlock for Ethereum that I can't even begin to describe, to be honest. So it's great to see them being so forward looking, to be honest.
Anthony, as we begin to close out this episode, I wanted to get into your personal on-chain wrapped. So somebody tweeted this out that somebody in crypto should create a Spotify wrapped, but for your wallet, essentially. And so the devs at Bankless actually did this. So Anthony, I am going to plug in your wallet. This is bankless.com/wrapped and just reveal what you've been up to on this address. I'm sure this is, so what is this wallet? This is not all your trading activity.
No, I'm sure you have all sorts of secret
wallets out there that you like aren't doxed, that no one knows about, where you're making like insane gains. But this wallet, what do you do in this wallet?
So this is my very public wallet. I don't do that much on this wallet. It's stuff that I don't care if people know that I'm doing. I do have separate wallets. I have one wallet that like I use just for trading like different very risky coins, like meme coins and AI coins, because I don't want anyone copy trading me. Also because I don't want them seeing my bad trades too. Because there are some bad trades on there.
I get it. Yeah, I'm with you. So this is Anthony's most wholesome wallet, let's say. So you're not going to see any of the fart coin trades that he's been making behind the scenes, I'm sure.
So here it is.
Let's take a deep dive into Anthony's wallet. So you performed 99 transactions this year from Sassel.eth, 45% more active than other bankless citizens. Your most traded token was USDC. I imagine you're just trying to sell all that fiat for like, Ether or something like this, right? You wake up bullish and you're buying Ether with your fiat. You're most loyal to Base. Your most commonly used layer two, your spirit animal. Let's see, Brian Apex Armstrong. That's your spirit animal. So there
you go.
Bald. We're both bold. So. How do we know this? It turns out your most active time was during July. 18% of your transactions. So you're you know, summertime, you had some energy.
It's winter for me in July, though. That's the thing. So
that's probably why.
He's indoors. What else are you going to do but trade crypto? Your crypto horoscope is a Cancer. And how bankless are you? Let's see. Here it is. Drum roll. 71 on the bankless score. Anthony
Sassano.
I'd love
to plug in some of my other addresses in that, on my own. Not on the stream, but on my own.
Yeah, we won't tell.
To see my score, yeah. And maybe talk to you about it. But this is cool. This is actually a really cool thing. I hadn't seen this yet. People should definitely plug their addresses into this, or other people's addresses as well. You know, I know there are a lot of people who have public addresses that they don't mind doing whatever on them because they want the attention, basically, and they want the fame, I guess.
So I don't know how this works, but I actually plugged in Vitalik.eth. And fun fact, you know who his spirit animal was?
No.
It was you. It was Anthony Sassano. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I don't know how the algo works. I'll have to, you know, consult the devs on that. But like, I don't know, you know, I'm sure the machine intelligence saw the similarities there with Anthony Vitalik.
Yeah. Vitalik and I are basically twins.
basically the same person.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to end with this. So I was thinking that we would have more of a bull market going into this episode, but I think we will in 2025. And I want your seasoned veteran advice. When we go into 2025 and things are feeling frothy, things are feeling bullish, how do we know it's a top? You know, this whole thing around top signals, okay? Mm-hmm. So I've got 9 top signals here for you, Anthony. And I want you to score them, if you will, one by one from 1 to 10, okay? And 1 is you're not seeing any of it exhibited. It's like deep bear market. Your sensors aren't tingling. It's like whatever. 1 is kind of low on the, is it a top scale? And 10 is you're seeing it everywhere. It's like high alert. Feels like the top. Feels super frothy, okay? You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
I snatched this from a crypto Twitter account. I'll have to include it in the show notes because I don't have it in my notes where these top signals are from. But here's the first one. Okay. So are people you know asking you about crypto right now? Again, 10, a lot of them, super frothy. I'm like scared. And like 1, not at all. It feels like a deep bear market. And they're like feeling sorry for you that you're like in the crypto industry. So what are you from 1 to 10 on this?
So a few days ago, I was a 5, but that's at like an 8 right now. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you. A guy that did some work on my house a couple of years ago that I hadn't spoken to in a couple of years called me to ask about crypto. And he's got nothing to do with crypto at all. And I was like, oh, no, we're already at that part of the cycle. So, yeah, I went straight to an 8 when I got that call. I was like, no, not already.
Yikes. Too soon. Okay, but no fear, guys. No need to panic yet. There's still 8 more. How about people flexing on the timeline? Are you seeing flexing on the timeline going on from 1 to 10?
Not much, actually. I would say maybe like a 3 or a 4, to be honest. I'm not seeing much. I saw some account post that he bought like a Porsche 911 the other day or something. Like,
oh my God.
I was like, okay, that's a bit of a flex, but it's just here and there. I'm not seeing a lot of it yet. So yeah.
Is that because we're in the ETH community, you and I? So you don't see any?
Maybe.
Moving on. How about number 3? Greed on the timeline. You seen any greed? It's a little bit different than flex. It's just like more like, oh my God, you got it. I'm investing in this thing and just like it's going to the moon, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I've been seeing that all year because, you know, obviously we've had the meme coin mania going off and a bunch of other kind of ecosystems having a bit of a pump. So I would say that it's probably like at a 5 still in terms of what I've seen. Like it's definitely not like what I saw in 2021 just yet.
That's good. Okay. How about when the market stops going up with positive news? Okay. So that's when the market's fatigued. You get this super positive thing and there's still not going up. So what's that for you? 1 to 10?
Yeah. I mean, probably like a 3 or 4, to be honest. But I feel like we've moved past that phase of the bull market so far and we're in the phase of it doesn't really matter at this point if it's negative or positive. The trend is still up. So yeah, we've kind of moved past that, I think.
Okay, how about crypto apps in the app store trending? You know, top 10, top 5.
Yeah, I mean Coinbase and Robinhood, which does crypto as well, have been there for a little while now, for multiple months. But I don't know if I would call that the same top signal that I would have last cycle. I feel like that crypto just has more general mind share now, more people are just generally aware of it and already have the apps on their phone and stuff like that. So, and they're just re-logging back in. So that again, yeah, maybe like a 5, I guess, or a 6. Yeah.
Okay, that's not too bad. All right, blood pressure going down a little bit. Search trends at historical high.
What was that?
Search trends, like Google results.
From what I've seen, they're not anywhere near their highs yet, or they're creeping back up, but they're definitely not at the 2021 levels. So yeah, again, like maybe even less than it, maybe like a 3 or a 4 right now.
Oh, that's good. Okay, crypto in mainstream news. You seen this in mainstream news?
Yes, Bitcoin mostly though, not crypto. Just Bitcoin, like in the mainstream news, especially because Trump's talked a lot about it. That's obviously a huge reason why it's in the news more. Outside of that, not as much, like just Bitcoin mainly. And that's usually not a top signal. That's usually just a signal of, oh, wow, the mainstream's paying attention to us again. It's when you start seeing the really kind of random degen crypto stuff that is a crypto insider thing start branching out into the wider ecosystem. That's when you can probably start like screaming. So I would say, again, this is probably like a 5.
Yeah, it's just Bitcoin and HawkTua. That's the only thing. HawkTua worries me. Okay. HawkTua worries me. Okay. How about people quitting their jobs? This is a peak bull market when people are like, I'm getting a job in crypto and I've been doing like corporate finance for 20 years, but now I'm doing crypto.
Yeah.
We do this at the tops.
Yeah, no, not necessarily. Not seeing much of that. I am seeing a bunch of people who joined a team like 3 years ago now going and like starting their own thing or kind of leaving and saying, I'm going to take a break for a bit, probably because they made a lot of money in the last 3 years and they're like, you know, I'm going to go and relax for a bit. So maybe a 5. Yeah, I'm not seeing too much of that. Yeah.
Okay, last one, then we'll sum this all up. Exaggerated price prediction. So that's where you start seeing people saying like, you know, Bitcoin to like, you know, 2 million or something. Or I remember last cycle, right? You and I were chanting ETH to 10K, ETH to 10K, right? As soon as we started saying that last cycle, people were like, 10K is bearish, ETH to 100K. You know what I mean? And that's at the point you're like, oh, okay, I don't know. Have you seen exaggerated price predictions yet this cycle, 1 to 10?
Yeah, I mean, I have, but the thing is that I've been seeing that on Bitcoin for a while now, like since even 2023, of people saying $1 million Bitcoin and so on and so forth. But what I will say is that I am seeing a lot of the people who were previously calling for maybe 150K to 200K Bitcoin start calling for like 500K now because whatever reason, obviously the froth in the bull market. And same on like ETH, like people just like to raise their targets as time goes on. But if I start seeing people give ridiculous prices for assets that are fundamentally worthless, that's when it goes to like 10 for me, because those assets are obviously been pumping a bit and people are like, oh my God, it's going to go to such and such. But no, I would say it's probably at like a 5 or maybe, nah, you know what? That's just closer to a 6, I think at this point, but, nothing too crazy just yet. But I think the common theme through all of this is that we're in the middle, right? That seems to be where all my answers landed.
Totally. Intermediate. I think we are a 5 or a 6, which is actually a good place to be as we end the year. Anthony Sestano, thank you so much for hanging with us. Remind people where they can get the Daily Gwei. Fantastic Ethereum education that you're putting out on the daily, almost, you know, like often,
I mean,
a lot.
These days it's a bit more sporadic, but I did make a New Year's resolution promise that I'll go back to doing it a lot more frequently. But yeah, if people want to follow me, they can just go find all the links on my Twitter. I do my Daily Gwei show, as you mentioned there, and I'm very active on Twitter. So I'm sure you'll link that in the show notes for people to check out.
Go check it out, guys. It's also available on podcast format, too. So if you're not tuned into Spotify, you can get on the podcast. We'll include a link to that. Got to end with this, of course. You guys know crypto is risky. It's been a good year, 2024, but you can lose what you put in. We are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.